Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We've got another slightly different lineup for you today because we're doing something boaty. I'm joined by Chris, because who better to talk about boaty stuff than our resident kind of German Navy, German princess, all-round metal boat correspondent. Chris Sams is in the house, but Chris, we're not doing metal boats, so why are you here?
Hi, Zach. I found this quite an interesting subject. I did one with Charlie a little while ago about, and we're talking about the Third Anglo-Dutch War, and I've started to get into wooden ships as well as a sort of general thing.
This is good. We are corrupting you.
Not enough German ships, but I found this really interesting. This is something I didn't really know that much about, and it's a really fascinating story.
So who's our guest today, and what are we talking about?
Okay, so today we have Alan Smith, who is a former journalist who now spends all of his free time dedicated to the noble art of naval history. He guides on HMS Victory. He's a volunteer at the Museum of Royal Navy in Portsmouth and is a researcher for the Diving Deep Invincible 1744 project. He's here today to discuss the subject of his new book, Balchen's Victory, the Loss and Rediscovery of an Admiral and His Ship.
Welcome, Alan. It's great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm good, apart from the horrible cold, but yeah, I'm ready for it.
Shall we start? Do you know what? I'm going to go off-piste, actually. We talk about Victory, and immediately everybody thinks of current Victory, if you will, because HMS Victory in Portsmouth Dry Dock is, of course, still a commissioned vessel in the Royal Navy. But we're not talking about that Victory, if I'm right in saying. So which Victory are we talking about here? Because there are a few that have this name.
Yeah, we're talking about the fifth Victory, would you believe? It was the predecessor of Nelson's Victory by about 30 years. She was launched in 1737. And actually, it was a peculiar time of rebuilding ships then. So although she was launched in 1737, in fact, her origins go back way, way back to the 1685, when she was launched as the Royal James. And that was the brother of Charles II. So it started life then. And you know, at that period, they used to take ships apart and rebuild them. She was a 110-gun ship, beautiful by all accounts. She was described as the finest, largest navy in the Royal Navy. And she had the largest guns available, big 42-pound guns, and a complete bespoke set of bronze guns, which, of course, shortly after that, they're superseded by iron guns and smaller guns. But yeah, she actually had an up-and-down life, the same as Balchen, not only having various collisions. She was rebuilt in the 1690s, 1694, 1695. And in 1721, she actually caught fire when they were breaming her, cleaning her bottom, and burnt almost down to the waterline. So they piled her up as a pile of timbers in Portsmouth Dockyard until 1726, when the Admiralty decided to rebuild her. So although she was a quite new ship, she had a lot of history behind her.
They also had a bit of a design quirk when they rebuilt her, didn't they? Because the surveyor of the Navy and the master shipwright had a bit of a falling out about how they wanted her built. And the shipwright disobeyed what he was told to and put in all these extra bits, which could prove detrimental later.
Yeah, I mean, most ships then, you know, they had the quarter deck, they had the poop deck, a poop royal. And for some reason on the latest Victory, they put a deck above the poop royal. So she had four galleries at the back of the ship there, extraordinarily high. And She was also quite short relative to the number of guns she had on her. So she tended to wallow, she's crank, which meant she had to have more and more ballast put down in the hold, which actually made her so close to the waterline that in the slightest swell, she couldn't even open her guns on the leeward side. So yeah, she was very much over height, but also there are questions about her timbers, because having been stowed on a pile of, still on the Admiralty books as HMS Victory, actually she was a pile of logs in the dockyard. So questions rose about, well, how many of those were suitable? Were they rotten? So there's...
Let's rewind then and talk about the big protagonist here, Balkan?
Yeah, I call him Balkan. Some people call him Balkan. But...
So he's born just 9 years after the Restoration and ends up making his way into Charles II's Navy Royal, doesn't he? So talk us through the, you know, his early life, his experiences, and his route into the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, he was born in February 1669 in Godalming in Surrey, but it was certainly volatile times, not only political and religious because of the Restoration, but also we'd come through a whole series of three Anglo-Dutch wars while he was in his youth. And in fact, he served under six different monarchs. So it just shows after over 60 years, six different monarchs. And of course, when he joined the Navy in 1685, age 15, very closely after that was the Glorious Revolution. William and Mary came in, and then the Nine Years' War started. So from a very early age, as soon as, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old, and they're at war, and there's all things going on around him. So his first commission actually was in the Caribbean, the West Indies. And of course, at the time, the death rate in the West Indies for officers and crew was tremendous, with yellow fever, malaria, and whatever. So in fact, he was a survivor. And it meant that on the first few years, in the whole of the 1690s is the West Indies. And the death rate amongst senior people meant that he rose through the ranks quite a lot. His first commission was a young lieutenant on a frigate, HMS Dragon. And we know from the probate records that during his time on the ship, at least two senior lieutenants died of yellow fever. So he was being promoted all the time, with actually probably working quite hard, but nevertheless, as a survivor, that's sort of what happened. He actually got his first commission there under Admiral Sir John Neville, because he transferred from the Dragon to the Admiral's flagship. And he obviously performed very well, because it was in about 1697 that they captured a French ship, the Virgin, and he was got his first command. And it wasn't through his friends or whatever, it was the Admiral promoted him to that. So he must have been doing fairly well as a young officer.
Like we said, this is a bit of a grey area for people in popular history with the naval. We've had the three Anglo-Dutch wars. Next, people tend to think of the Royal Navy and sort of the Napoleonic period and about the sort of grandstanding and sweeping everyone out of the way. What was the Royal Navy like in this period as he was starting to take his first steps on the command ladder?
Well, the United Provinces, or the Dutch and the English, certainly were the two powerhouses in terms of maritime powers. But they'd been, between 1652 and 1674, there were three Anglo-Dutch wars. So while they were tearing each other's navies apart, the French suddenly woke up to the fact that they had no empire across the world there. And under Louis XIV, the great Sun King, he started to rebuild the navy. So although it was certainly not Nelson's powerhouse, it was certainly up there, but it was then in a position where it needed a quick catch up. The French were building new arsenals right across France, at Brest, at Nantes, and so Rochefort. So really it was a question of rebuilding while the next war, the Nine Years' War, came up. But I have to say, by about 1707, the War of Spanish Succession, the Royal Navy had basically crawled itself back to be mistress of the seas, because neither the French nor the Spanish would actually come out to have a major battle. They'd rather send out privateers to disrupt merchant ship. So it's true to say that she was a leading power by 1707, 1708, certainly by the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713. The trouble is, as we go through his career, Balchen's career and the ship's career, between 1713 and 1739, the next war that started, during those years of peace, it was a pacifist government under Robert Walpole, and they stopped any spending on the Navy or the armed forces. So when war started in 1739, although we still technically had a big Navy, there's only 35 ships that fit for service. So it had to rebuild itself again then. But I think that one of the fundamentals of the book is that the catastrophe that led to this HMS Victory going down and Balchen going down was a massive catalyst. The Admiralty Board was cleared out within 2 months. Lord Anson came on as captain at the time. And that was really the catalyst for the massive changes that actually led to the powerhouse of Nelson's Navy.
There's so much that I want to dive into, and I think we'll come back to what happens to this victory a little bit later. But I want to just kind of dwell on his kind of combat record and his combat experience for a second, if we can, because his first taster of full-scale, inverted commas, battle comes in 1702. Tell us about that and his role within that, and you know, the impact of that on him and his experiences.
Yeah, it was the start of the War of the Spanish Succession, and although there'd been various engagements, the first major one was actually under quite a big fleet under Admiral Sir George Rooke, and he had quite a big fleet squadron that went down to try and capture Cadiz, but failed. And in that squadron, Balchen was there on a 28-gun HMS Vulcan, a fire ship. And on the way back, they met this huge convoy of transport ships and French escort ships entering the Bay of Vigo. And basically, it was a complete wipeout of the whole fleet. We captured six of the French warships, escort ships, and burnt or destroyed six others. And the whole of 19 Spanish ships were captured at the same time. So it was a spontaneous engagement, as it were. And in fact, despite having quite a small ship on Vulcan, the records show that he actually captured a French ship called the Modere, 56-gun Modere, which then he took over as HMS Moderate. So that was his a command there that he'd taken over in 1703. That was his first major battle.
A few years later, though, he's on the receiving end of the opposite sort of end of that, with the Battle of the Lizard, where he's part of the escort. What happens there, and what goes wrong for him?
Yeah. Bless him. He'd just come back from two commissions on the coast of Guinea. And if you thought the West Indies was a bad place to get ill, the coast of Guinea was pretty bad. So he just come back from that, and he was ordered to join a five-ship squadron under Commodore Edwards to escort a fleet of merchant ships. And so there's only five ships there, and they're going past Lizard off Cornwall. And out of the blue, two huge squadrons under Admiral Duguay-Trouin and de Forbin. And there were two, although they were in the French Navy, they were privateers, because they're actually sponsored, because as I say, the French would not come out in full fleet battle. And so they arrived on the scene with 12 mighty warships. And of course, Balchen's ship was all of them were overtaken. Only one escaped of those five ships. One blew up, and Balchen's ship was captured, the HMS Chester. And it was one-sided. And we come to meet Duguay-Trouin again after that. But if I may, there's a little piece which is it's the court-martial, because when you lose your ship, you're court-martialed. And there's a tiny little piece here, which I've quoted from the court-martial. It just describes what this guy was like. The Chester was in her proper station, was engaged until being boarded by three of ye enemy ships. And at last, they having entered many men and his own men driven off ye deck and the ship much disabled, Captain Balchin was seized on ye quarter-deck, and the enemy then got possession of his ship, and the court being satisfied that Balchin in all particulars discharged his duty on this occasion, the court did acquit Captain Balchin. You just imagine there on the quarterdeck, and the troops are firing over there, and he's, yeah, all right. So, yeah, he was released on parole in 1708, and he was then exchanged in 1709. So they gave him another ship, and bless him. He goes out on this brand new ship, HMS Gloucester. And he is captured again. he bumps into Dugay-Truin and completely outnumbered. And Dugay-Truin is on his flagship, a 74-gun ship, against poor old Gloucester. And yeah, the story goes on. He gets court-martialed again. But again, he is, I think they describe him as... it is ye opinion of ye court that ye said Captain Balchin and other officers and men did discharge their duties very well in this action against so unequal a power of the enemy. So he got completely exonerated again. So he'd been through the mill by 1709.
Yeah, he's been somewhat unfortunate, but his personal bravery and exonerates him. I guess there was literally nothing he could do to avoid those situations.
No, I mean... I would say, because there weren't any fleet actions, it was that the Royal Navy was they couldn't entice anybody out of Brest or Nantes or Rochefort or Cadiz. So it's a question of just guiding, escorting convoy ships to keep the merchant going to the Americas, to India, to the Caribbean. And of course, the French would come out in small groups and attack. So it was unavoidable. By the same token, the Royal Navy was doing the same. So trying to intercept any traffic going between the Caribbean, the Americas, Canada, back into France again. So once he's back in service on this 54-gun frigate in 1709, HMS Colchester, he's doing the same as Dugay-Truin. He's up and down the channel, and he captures at least four merchant and warships and getting the prize money in for that, etc. And he had a whale of a time until the Peace of Utrecht in 1713, because he'd also go down to the Mediterranean. And that's, again, where he proved himself, and he's amassing prize money then, but no full battle at the time.
That is up until about the Battle of Cape Pizarro.
Yeah, after the Treaty of Utrecht, the Spanish decided that they shouldn't have signed that treaty. And they decided to carry on recapturing stuff that they'd lost under the treaty. So in 1717, they captured Sardinia, and then they'd gone on to capture Sicily. Now, Britain wasn't at war with Spain at the time, but nevertheless, they were... allied to the emperor, the Austrians. So a huge fleet was sent down under, you mentioned Byng. This was Admiral Sir George Byng. And he was sent down with a fleet of 22 ships to the Mediterranean with the intention of basically saber rattling. But as these happen sometimes, the saber rattling got a bit vicious. And they got down to Cape Pizarro on the southern coast of Sicily. Balchin was on HMS Shrewsbury, an 80-gun ship, which was the flagship of Admiral Sir Charles Cornwall. And they met this huge fleet of 27 Spanish ships just off the coast. And without ordering a battle or anything, they just basically gave chase. And the Spanish fired at them. That meant, hey, we're having a fight here. So the Battle of Pizarro, no war was declared, there's no battle signal, but they engaged the fleet, and it was absolute mayhem. They captured 16 Spanish ships of the line and frigates, and captured both of the Spanish admirals. And it was an interesting engagement. And he again, the records show that Balchub behaved with the greatest courage and intrepidity, whatever that means. He's intrepid anyway.
Yeah. It always seems to be the Navy that pick these fights, start these fights. Yeah. That kind of. I wonder if we can tease this. That leads us on quite nicely to what kind of a picture of the man are we getting? Are there any records of what, apart from what we've said already, that sort of describe him and his command style or his personality?
Well, there's lots of examples of his character. There were at least two or three complaints made against him to the Admiralty that he was misusing somebody. But then you see his letters in defence of himself. He said, well, hang on, this guy was a bad guy. He kept on disobeying orders. That's why I had him flogged. But on the other hand, he's also very compassionate. One of the Admiralty jobs that they gave him was to say, look, there's complaints down in Plymouth about the bakers, suppliers of bread to the fleet was not the size of proportion it should be, and they're being ripped off, basically. So he goes down and he calls a whole lot of people up on deck of various ships and said, what are your complaints? I won't shout at you, but what is the problem with this? And he said, we don't have a problem. Where the complaints come from. So he goes down to the baker and he says, I want to test 20 loaves of bread, please. And then he weighs them. And he says, no, there's nothing wrong with it. But there's a reality about him. He's a very pragmatic guy. But I think the main thing that comes through, he's a family man. After the Battle of Pizarro, when he first came back from the Caribbean, he married Susanna, a priest, in 1698, who's the daughter of a colonel. And they had six children. By that time, he was living in the Covent Garden area, and that's where all his children were baptized, although only two survived him. It's a rather tragic picture. And so after the Battle of Pizarro and the various prize monies he'd got, he then moves into a very prestigious Cheney Walk in Chelsea, a big four-story building there where he stayed most of his life. So he's going up the ranks and he's becoming a more important person. His daughter then goes on to marry Temple West, Captain Temple, who becomes Admiral Temple West. He also has a memorial in Westminster Abbey. His eldest son, his surviving son, actually died the year after him in 1745 in Barbados. He's captain of a frigate called Pembroke. So, but yeah, he was a family man, but he never entered politics. And that period, you've got the likes of Admiral Wager, Admiral Norris, Vernon, and they're all MPs, all being fired. And so they got involved in politics, which was not a good thing at that time. Because there's a change of government, you're out. You know, you became off the Admiralty board, or you're taken away from commission of running the Mediterranean fleet or whatever. So he didn't do that. He did as he's told. He's very, very loyal. And he wherever he was told to go, he went. He did his stuff.
So in 1744, he retires. But that's just the beginning of the story, isn't it?
It's the beginning of the end. Yeah. The tragedy is he'd served for 58 years. And he retired in April, and on a salary of a pension of £600 a year, which is a substantial amount of money then. And in May, so retired in April, in May he was knighted by George II. He was given the title of Governor of the Greenwich Naval Hospital, which again was worth £1,000 a year. And a month later, in June the 1st, in fact, the Admiralty, they're on the phone saying, excuse me, can you come back? And they made him Admiral of the White and gave him a huge fleet of 27 ships and said, go off and relieve this convoy out in the River Tagus. So he had a very, very short retirement. In fact, he never even got to Greenwich, such was the shortness of retirement. So in a way, it is a culmination, because he's 75 years old, and yet they still went to him rather than any other senior. There are plenty of senior officers around, but they dragged him out, and he chose HMS Victory to be his flagship. And there were 17 British and 6 Dutch ships in this fleet. And the importance of it was that the Mediterranean fleet was desperate for provisions. They'd run out of sail, they'd run out of victuals, they'd run out of rope. And every time that the provisioning squadron went out, it was meant to be every 6 weeks, they kept on being intercepted by the French. So it's long overdue, and they were desperate for this convoy. The French anticipated this, and they knew the state of the Mediterranean. So when the huge victualling squadron set off, they went into the River Tagus estuary in Lisbon, and the French then blockaded them in. They wouldn't let them out. So this was quite a desperate situation in the period of the war, where it was touch and go whether the Mediterranean fleet would survive or not. So Balchen was put in charge of this fleet, and he made his way down to the River Tagus. As soon as he got off Lisbon, the French ran away into Cadiz, because they were such a huge squadron. And so he picked up the convoy, took it down to Gibraltar, and mission accomplished, basically. He wanted to stay there and draw the French out of Brest or Cadiz, but unfortunately the Dutch ships ran out of water. So he's forced to come back. And it was on the 3rd and 4th of October, 1744, as he entered the English Channel, there's an almighty storm. And of all the ships, they gradually came back over the next few days, completely bedraggled. They'd thrown guns overboard because of the threat to sink. Their main yards have been taken off. The ships, they all returned, but they were in a critical state in Plymouth, in Spithead, and in the Downs. But the only ship that didn't come back was the Victory. She'd gone down what was thought was on the Casquets Reef in Alderney, because that's where they found remnants, gun carriages and masts and everything to prove that it was the Victory, and not a single body was found. And on that ship, not only was Admiral Sir John Balchen, but the captain, Samuel Faulkner, was a very senior captain, and 1,100 crew, including over 50 young gentlemen who were from noble families, who were specially put on board to learn from this great master, where they knew that there was going to be a victory anyway. So it was a devastating impact on the country.
Yeah, so apart from the horrific loss of human life, how did it impact Britain? Because this is something that's, I think I'll probably be okay to say, it's not something that's widely that known about now, but at the time, this is a massive tragedy.
Yeah, it already been acknowledged that the Victory was the pride of the Royal Navy. It was the most prestigious ship there. The shock of it going down, because the Admiralty knew that she was crank, that she was she shouldn't have gone out in the winter. It's a summer ship, but they didn't know about that. They just knew that this is mighty ship there, and Balchen was incredibly well known in the press. I mean, the press was very much pro Navy, and they wanted to know what was happening. So when this great admiral disappeared, and the ship and the enormity of 1,100 crew. So in terms of Joe Public, the newspapers were full of it. Poems were written, songs were written. There was artwork done, there was etchings, there was paintings of the ship going down, outpourings of grief, especially somewhere like Portsmouth, when most of the crew were from Portsmouth. So it was a devastating effect. On the other hand, that's the Joe Public reaction to it. From the Navy's point of view, Admiral Vernon and various other people, Knowles, have been complaining about the state of shipbuilding and ship administration and ship design. So in the official side of things, it was a catastrophe. And it led, I mean, that was in October. By December the 22nd, the Navy Board had been sacked. Earl Winchelsea, the first Sea Lord, was dismissed, and they brought a new board in, which included the Duke of Bedford and the Earl of Sandwich and Anson. They were the three biggest reformers that actually tore up the copybook, decided to redo the design of ships, naval administration, dockyard administration, which actually was the catalyst to then rebuilding the Navy from the 1747 right through to Nelson's powerhouse, as I said before.
So the ship goes down. The Admiral and his ship sort of slip into obscurity, or at least they did until 2008. What happens?
Yeah, in 2008, everybody thought, because of the records of the time, that the ship had gone down in the Caskets Reef in Alderney. In 2008, an American exploration company, salvage company, Odyssey Marine Exploration, discovered a wreck in the middle of the channel, 70 kilometers southeast of Plymouth and 100 kilometers west of the Channel Islands. So it just debunked the whole idea that she'd hit the reef. She'd actually gone down, which was actually demonstrates the problems with the ship itself. And they pulled up two guns, a 12-pound bronze gun and a 42-pound bronze gun. They retrieved it to identify, was this the wreck of Victory? And that was confirmed that that's what it was. So the two guns were then given to the National Museum of the Royal Navy to renovate and conserve and to put on public display. When it was discovered in 2008, 2009, there's been basically 10 years of political and legal wrangling about what to do with the ship. On the one hand, they wanted to retrieve artifacts. They couldn't have brought the whole ship up. They could have brought a lot of artifacts up. So it wasn't a question of like a Mary Rose, but it was something to get a whole lot of material up to study and et cetera. On the other hand, there's a big maritime archaeology argument that no, let us stay in peace. It's a war grave, if you like. We've got two guns up here. So this went on through judicial reviews, a high court hearing, and eventually the MOD said, no, let her lie where she is. The argument being that the argument for bringing stuff up was because deep sea trawlers were going to disrupt the site. They'll be looting and all the rest of it. But the assurance from the MOD was that no, let her lie there 24/7. We can monitor what's going to go on. And basically a whole lot of it is emotive because the descendant, the last descendant of Admiral Balchen was Richard Temple West. And he was arguing passionately to let the ship and its people rest in peace. Unfortunately, he died in 2018, 2019. Before I actually got to meet him, and I was so upset about that because I think I tried to bring back to life this great man.
Yeah, there is that kind of grey area between when does archaeology stop being grave robbing, and it's especially difficult with marine archaeology with ships that go down because, as you said, they are someone's tomb, and there's that kind of study of history outweighing respect, so it does become a bit problematic.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for the wreck now? Is it just going to, she will just be left in peace?
Yeah, I think it was last year the Joint Services Subaqua Group from Plymouth, they went out there to inspect. They got special permission, and they sent me a whole lot of underwater pictures of it, and it's quite a moving sight when you've got the underwater pictures. You've got the divers in there, And there's these great guns, just literally one gun piled up over the other, and there's bits of timber there. And I've recently been involved in the dives on the wreck of HMS Invincible that went down in 1758, and that's just 3.2 nautical miles off Old Portsmouth. And so I'm familiar with what it looks like. But then, having got this far with the book, just about to be published, and we get all these pictures of real time of the wreck, is just so emotive. And you think, Elchin's down there, and all these people, and what a history. So when you go to Portsmouth now, the National Museum of the Royal Navy, there's that big 42-pound bronze gun sitting there on display, and people are amazed. Well, I thought that's the victory. No, this is another victory. And whilst that is becoming more visible, I just hope that that will also remind us not only of the ship, but the man behind it. So the purpose of my book was actually to coincide with this gun there. What is behind that gun? What is the history behind that gun? And what about the people, especially Balchin?
Which is a really nice point at which to plug your book vociferously, if we may. So remind everybody about the title and crucially where they can get it.
Yeah, it's published by Pen and Sword. And you can get the book from Pen and Sword. I think it's under Amazon as well. It's in the US Naval Institute on their website. I know that in my local Waterstones, they've sold out their copies. So it's basically available on the website, W.H. Smith. It's on the website of Waterstones and various deals are there. I know on the Pen and Sword, on their own website, they're doing a deal on it, which is slightly cheaper than the list price.
Folks, Balchin's Victory, go buy it. It's a fascinating read. Alan, it's been really interesting talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.